Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 24th of July 2026 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. I have my co-host with me today, of course, Jeff Roberts, the UK publisher for ArmReg, that's Germel Rudolph's book company, and we're going to be talking some more about William the Conqueror. Jeff, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Good day to you. How are things with you? Everything's fine with me. You know, everything's going quite well.
Excellent, excellent. And of course, there's the PA conference coming up in October as well. And hopefully you'll be able to sell some more of your books there. So if people want to meet you or they want to meet me, they should get along to the PA conference. I will actually be speaking at this year's conference as well. Also, Sam Melia will be speaking there. Laura Towler, Mark Collette, and of course there are always special guests that aren't announced until the actual day. If you want to get tickets for that, get along to patrioticalternative.org.uk and you'll be able to buy your tickets there. And they're not too expensive either. As I say, you'll be able to meet Jeff there and you'll also be able to meet me there. That's the adverts out of the way. Let's have a short summary of where we got to last week in last week's episode. After making use of a feigned retreat from the battlefield, William was able to surround Harold and his men with archers who fired their arrows up into the sky, causing one to go straight through Harold Godwinson's eye, ending the Saxon chapter of British history. And that was where we got up to last week. And we're going to have a brief summary, basically, of what we've just gone through in the last few episodes, and we'll be taking quotes from Sharon Turner's History of the Anglo-Saxons, Book 2, published in 1841, once we get into that. But I'll just ask you, Jeff, have you got any comments you want to make on the last episode or about what happened here to Harold Godwinson?
Yes, it's quite interesting looking at the Bay of Tapestry to see that the arrow that hit Harold is depicted from coming from a sharp angle, and that perhaps archers were shooting up at the Saxons at the same time they was actually dropping the arrows over the back to hit the lesser armoured men. But they say this is a modern addition. And this person was actually holding a spear. So which would sort of take, which would be relevant, because I would have thought Harold would have been armed with the Saxon axe, double-handed sort of axe, which seems more likely with a character that is actually been cut down by the Norman horsemen in the same scene.
Is that on the tapestry, is it?
That's right, yes. It's not sure where the wording is referring to. It may be that a person was actually carrying a spear and the Norman horse broke through the ring and then killed the character with the double-handed axe. It sounds more likely to me that Harold actually had a double-handed axe than a spear.
So you think it might not have actually been hit by an arrow through the eye then? It might have been the horse that took him down?
Well, the obvious thing is that the cavalry are attacking and the arrow angle, so it seems like it's coming from the bottom of the hill, but it would be difficult to actually shoot these arrows, you know, over the top of your cavalry, so perhaps this is why William sort of got his archers to shoot up in the air, so they're hitting the people at the back of the ranks.
Ah, right, I've got you. The front ranks. I've got you, and he was there at the back of the ranks, and then it was just by chance that it hit him in the eye. I mean, it would almost certainly have killed him pretty much outright at the point. And I think you pointed out last week as well with the body that they wouldn't let his family have the body, and then you were suggesting that perhaps his body ended up in Bosham. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. The situation is they haven't actually been able to exhume this body, but it's known that Canute's daughter is actually there at Bosham. So it could be a likely situation, but a lot of the time the churches don't really cooperate with any sort of historical research, like the Princes in the Tower at St. Paul's, for example. I think a lot of people would be absolutely fascinated to see if there's any DNA from them could be extracted, and whether they actually had any those related, to Edward the Fourth, which would be something like that. But I think people would be very quite interested to hear about.
So I guess they don't want the bodies to be exhumed. I guess it's on sacred ground. I mean, I guess that could be a reason why they don't want this to happen. But of course, the same thing happens, doesn't it? You know, the Jews say the same. They say, oh, no, we don't want you digging around any of these work camps because we have a Jewish law that you mustn't disturb the bodies, effectively. And of course, that prevents people from being able to verify the numbers of people that killed in those camps, or these sort of eyewitness reports of burning of bodies and all that sort of thing. And that can't actually be checked because Jewish religion apparently says that you mustn't disturb these bodies. So it's possibly the same thing with the clergy saying that you shouldn't disturb these bodies. Of course, they do when they have to build in those areas. They will exhume the bodies and they'll put them somewhere else. But I guess they don't actually, maybe they don't open the caskets or something like that. Well, let's get into our notes here from the, and this is really the final chapter from Sharon Turner's book as well. William escaped unhurt, but the slaughter of his Normans had been great. His victory was splendid, but if Harold had not fallen, it would have contributed very little to gain the crown of England. It was the death of Harold which gave William the sceptre. The force of England was unconquered. A small portion of it only had been exerted, and if Harold had survived, or any other heir at all competent to the crisis, William would have earned no more from his victory than the privilege of fighting another battle with diminished strength. So effectively, I mean, it's pretty lucky that he actually took him out, and very unlucky that there wasn't anybody else that could challenge this. Basically, it wasn't as if William defeated all the forces of England. What he did was he took out the leader of these forces. And once you've taken out the leader, effectively, that's it. You have to surrender. Any thoughts on that, Jeff?
Well, you're absolutely right there, Ben. The situation was that not only did the Normans kill Harold Godwinson, but they also killed his two brothers. And it makes you wonder why you'd put all your hairs in one basket, as it were. You know, he could have sort of dispatched one of his brothers to be on the fleet, or he could have dispatched him elsewhere to get round the flanks of the Normans. But he decided to keep them all together. Perhaps it's this mistaken sort of sense of honour, which, to sort of send your brother away somewhere else would have been regarded as a slight. You know, perhaps they didn't want to do that. You know, perhaps he thought he couldn't do that because it might look really poor before his men. But it does sound very strange that, his house has virtually come to an end virtually completely, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, it shows you that he's not really a military man. He doesn't really have much experience of these things, whereas William does. When he landed in England, he came with all his power. The fleet of the Anglo-Saxons was afterwards ready to cut off a further succour, if such could have been raised for him in Normandy. And it is probable that if by the fall of Harold, England had not been suddenly left without a chief, the Battle of Hastings would have been to William but a scene of brilliant glory, speedily followed by a melancholy catastrophe. Of course, what he's referring to there is instead of taking these soldiers with him to fight against William, Harold sent off a third of his soldiers to go out in ships in the English Channel so that they could cut William off if he tried to go back to France. And we were saying, well, this is not a very clever move of Harold, because he needed those men around him to fight against William rather than putting them out in the Channel doing nothing, effectively. But what Sharon Turner is saying here, that if Harold hadn't actually been killed in this instant, then that would have been a good move, because it would have cut William off from getting further supplies, and Harold could have turned the country against him. You want to make a comment on that, Jeff?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The situation here is Harold doesn't seem to be a very good tactician He's quite good at the strategy. Probably the right idea was to move in against the Norman invasion as soon as you can. But he didn't have to actually get to a position where he was under attack, and especially, as I said, with his brothers. And then we have now have the Saxon fleet, which perhaps we need to do more research with. But now that seems to be cutting off William's supply lines, which sounds like a good idea. But how about all these troops on the fleets? That does seem to be very, very strange. If it's just acting as a military interdiction of William's supplies, do you need all those troops on the fleet? Surely they would have been better with him at Hastings, wouldn't they?
Yeah, well, also, William was actually purchasing his supplies from the Englishman. He brought enough wealth with him so that he could purchase supplies instead of having to get them from elsewhere. All right, in great revolutions, much is affected by active talents, but perhaps more by that arrangement of events over which man has no control. It was William's intention to have sailed a month sooner than he appeared. If his wishes had been fulfilled, he would have invaded Harold before the King of Norway and would perhaps have shared his fate. For if the English king, with the disadvantages of a loss and desertion of his veteran troops, of new levies, of an inferior force, and an overweening presumption, was yet able to balance the conflict with William's most concentrated, select, and skilfully exerted strength until night was closing, if the victory was only decided by his casual death, how different would have been the issue if Harold had met him with the troops with which he marched against the Norwegians. But Providence had ordained that a new dynasty should give new manners, new connections, and new fortunes to the English nation. So again, you see, just by chance, William was delayed by a month. If he had actually set out at the time that he wanted to set out, he would have got there before Harold Hardrada got there, and he might have lost because Harold Godwinson would have had all his troops there. He would have had all his men there, which is why he was able to kill Hardrada. And of course, it was after that he didn't allow his troops to take any of the plunder. He took all the plunder for himself. He didn't pay them, and he lost at least a third of his force, effectively. So it was only a chance by the winds that prevented William from leaving at the time he wanted to. And if he'd left at the time he wanted to, then he might have actually lost this battle. So that's why he's talking about Providence here. And of course, Sharon Turner is a Christian man. Britain itself was probably 100% Christian at this time in the 1860s. And that's the way that he's looking at it. He's saying, well, God ordained this effectively, that he ordained that William would win. And there was nothing really that Harold Godwinson could have done to prevent it when you look at it like that. Any thoughts on that, Jeff?
Yes, that's very interesting, actually. It reminds me of the situation with the Battle of Yorktown in the rebellion in America, or the American Revolution, as it's sometimes called. And the situation was that the French and the British fleets were balanced in North America, but what they used to do is send most of their fleets to the West Indies because you had the sugar crop, which was very, very important. And then the French fleet was supposed to come to North America, and they had calculated he would send, the French admiral would send a part of his fleet. But what happened was De Grasse, the French admiral, actually sent all of his entire fleet. So that sort of mucked up British naval supremacy in North America, and effectively enabled them to lay siege to Cornwallis's forces at Yorktown and thus achieve a victory. So how much did Harold know from spies and other people that William was going to land at a certain time? It seems very crucial, this sort of date, doesn't it? This delay of the date, which completely unhinges Harold's campaign. And you would think to yourself, well, Did he know somebody who was actually telling him that he's going to arrive there, gave the right information, but then the winds mucked it all up? This seems to happen a lot in wards, especially when you actually go by cell. You know, you can't, it's very difficult to coordinate something at this sort of time.
Yeah, that's a good point. Was Harold actually expecting him to arrive at that time? And you know, there's evidence to show that he was, because he only provided enough supplies for his navy to last for a certain amount of time, didn't he? And by the time that William had set off, the navy had actually run out of supplies. So it does sound as if Godwinson was expecting William to arrive at a certain time, and then he was delayed. Events were therefore so made to follow that all the talents of Harold and the force of England should not avail against the vicissitudes intended. While Harold's fleet watched the ocean, the adverse wind kept William in port. This fleet was dispersed by its stores failing, and at the same time, the invasion of the King of Norway compelled Harold to leave his coast unguarded and to hurry his soldiers to the north of the island. In this critical interval, while Harold was so occupied by land and before his fleet had got revictualled, the winds became auspicious to William and he landed in safety. So that bit there, I mean, that does sort of imply that he was expecting William to land there. That's why the fleet were there. They didn't have enough supplies to last much longer, and he ended up having to move them north to cope with Harold Hardrada. So I think you're right there, Jeff. I think he did have information from spies that that's what time William was going to arrive there. Immediately after this, the Saxon fleet was enabled to sail. Harold had in the meantime conquered the Norwegians, but this very event, which seemed to ensure the fate of William, became his safety. It inflated Harold's mind so as to disgust his own soldiery and to rush to a decisive conflict in contempt of his adversary, before he was prepared to meet him. So his soldiers got fed up with him. I mean, he wouldn't allow them to have any of the plunder which they got from Harold Godwinson. He took all of that for himself, and he was obviously being extremely conceited about this and wanted to rush to another conflict with William straight away, whereas his soldiers were saying, this is ridiculous, you know, we haven't got any energy. Why would you do something like this? But Harold was all puffed up by his own pride, effectively. That was the reason why it happened. Do you want to make a comment on that, Jeff?
And that's a good point. You know, if we look at, say, the English Civil War, the idea was to draw out your men and fight the enemy. It wasn't there to sort of go into sort of fancy strategy and move about all over the place and whatever. And it does seem like this was based on Harold's decision to have his fleet sort of ready at a certain time. It was all there. It was all quite ready to meet the Norman aggressor. And it seems like the landing of the Normans should not have happened in his view. And when it actually did, obviously large numbers of people would be saying, what are we going to do about it? What are we going to do about it? And they're expecting the king to actually march his forces down there and repeat what he did to Harold Hardrada. But there must have been a great deal of factors for him not to have done that. But there must have been a lot of pressure on him to actually have gone into the attack as soon as possible.
Yeah, there would have been pressure to do that. And also his own conceit. But then the other soldiers were saying, look, you know, we need a rest and we need more men. You can't go down there with a third less men than you should have. When the battle had begun, the abilities of Harold and the bravery of his countrymen seemed again likely to ruin the hopes of his great competitor. But the death of Harold then terminated the contest, while William, who had been in as much danger as Harold, was not penetrated by a single weapon. But it was ordained by the supreme director of events that England should no longer remain insulated from the rest of Europe, but should, for its own benefit and the improvement of mankind, become connected with the affairs of the continent. And I'll just pause there, because I thought that England was quite connected with the affairs of the continent at about the time of Alfred the Great, because he was particularly impressed with the court of Charlemagne. and the Carolingian Empire, effectively. And he wanted to model England on this, on what was actually happening in France. And he also imported tradesmen and teachers and artisans from all over the continent to teach his Saxons how to do the work that they were effectively doing. And also at the time, he got one of the Welsh priests to come and teach his men to read and write, because they'd even forgotten how to read and write, the Saxons, by this time. And Alfred the Great managed to turn everything around, but he did a lot of that with the help of people from Ireland, Wales, France. So I'm not really quite sure why Sharon Turner is saying there that it was should no longer remain insulated from the rest of Europe, because I don't think Britain was insulated from the rest of Europe. Would you agree with that, Jeff?
Well, I think so. I think you're right. We have to remember that Harold Godwin's mother was actually a Dane, and there's quite a considerable interaction with other peoples in Britain who came from other sort of places. And obviously, you've got the Saxons, you've got the Welsh, and you've got the Danes in a large part of eastern England. So there's a considerable amount of interaction with people from Europe. And so the other thing is, like, perhaps the word insulated is probably wrong. You know, perhaps she meant isolated, not insulated. It does seem to be a bit strange, because Harold was quite a cosmopolitan sort of king. He wasn't sort of an insular sort of ruler.
Yeah, perhaps it's just referring to the fact that it was a Norman dynasty from then on, and they were explicitly French. I think Sharon Turner is actually male as well. I mean, obviously it sounds like a female name, but I thought there was male for some reason. Perhaps we'll have to look into that. The Anglo-Saxon dynasty was therefore terminated, and a sovereign with great continental possessions was led to the English throne. By the consequences of this revolution, England acquired that interest and established that influence in the transactions and fortunes of its neighbours, which have continued to the present day with equal advantages to its inhabitants and to Europe. And that sort of ends the book of the Anglo-Saxons, basically, Sharon Turner's book on the Anglo-Saxons. And then we move into the Norman period with William the Norman. So I haven't managed to find any other sort of alternative media to find more information on the Normans. So I went to Wikipedia, and our next quotes come from Wikipedia. So directly after the battle, William may have hoped that the English would surrender following his victory, but they did not. Instead, some of the English clergy and the magnates nominated Edgar the Etheling as king, though their support for Edgar was only lukewarm. After waiting a short while, William secured Dover, parts of Kent and Canterbury, while also sending a force to capture Winchester, where the royal treasury was. And these captures secured William's rear areas and his line of retreat to Normandy, if that was needed. William then marched to Southwark across the Thames from London, which he reached in late November. Next, he led his forces around the south and the west of London, burning along the way. Now that surprises me, because, you know, at first he was purchasing his food and he was purchasing his supplies, and he didn't want to turn the people against him. But now it appears that now he's trying to show his strength, effectively, burning places as he makes his way around London. And you can also see that where the clergy and the magnates were nominating Edgar the Etheling as king, the clergy have set themselves up as his enemy, effectively. And I think part of what was happening at this time, you had a split in the church. You had the Catholic Church, effectively, and that split into the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church. And the Eastern Orthodox Church did not have the Pope at the head of the church. And I think England at this time was considered Anglo-Orthodox. Like, the Orthodox Church considers England up to this point to have been an Orthodox jurisdiction, not a Catholic jurisdiction. So I think these priests would have been like Greek Orthodox priests, effectively, the same as the type of Christianity that they have in Russia. And then when William went in and took the throne, effectively, he was backed by the Pope. And one of the first things he did was actually to change all the clergy. So not only did you have the clergy that was supporting somebody else as king, but also the clergy were loyal to the Eastern Orthodox Church. And it was at this point that Britain became tied to the Pope, effectively, and the Roman Catholic Church. Any thoughts on that, Jeff?
It's very interesting what you were saying there, you know, that the religious sort of matters are quite well known. But I think I'd like to get to back to this logistics with the supplies. Because I've heard accounts that apparently what the Normans did, they was running out supplies, so they used to raid large parts of Sussex and Kent to get supplies. And they actually had a sort of deliberate sort of campaign of attrition against the Saxons. And this might have led to the Saxons to launch this ill-judged attack straight away. It had been very hard for Harold Godwinson to actually resist the cries of his men calling for vengeance and let's get in there and attack now. But supplies are very sort of important to any sort of army. At various times in the American War of Independence, the British Army, which is mainly stationed at New York, was in desperate need of supplies. And it was only sometimes that the army was actually saved by the supply fleet arriving just in time. But what can we sort of think that the situation with the Bay of Tapestry, would it actually sort of depict the Normans sort of raiding and attacking people and burning their villages and everything like that? I don't think that would have been a very good idea by the person who commissioned it. I think it was Odo of Canterbury. You know, he's William's his own brother. I don't think he would actually have mentioned that, even perhaps knew, he probably knew whether it happened or not, or a thought.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. When we look at this history, you've got to look at the people that are telling the history. It's like when B tells the religious history or the ecclesiastical history of the Saxons in England, and he's really not going to make much about the fact that Britain was Christian at that point anyway, and the people that became the Welsh, the Britons, they'd been Christian for a couple of hundred years by that point, and they had a civilization, and they defeated the Romans twice. And of course, Bede isn't going to come at it from that angle because he's writing for the Anglo-Saxons, so he's going to make the Welsh out to be really not up to much, basically, and he's not going to make anything of the fact that they were Christian. Of course, we can see that they were certainly more advanced than the Saxons, because by the time you get to Alfred the Great has to send to Wales in order to get a priest to come from Wales to teach his men how to read and write. So that just shows you the difference in the way that Bede writes about things and then what we actually know about history from these other views. So if you've got William's brother who's actually commissioning this tapestry, of course it's not going to show him burning and torturing things. It's going to try and portray him in a very positive light. And it's the same today when you get propaganda that's put out by whatever country is putting out that propaganda. They're going to paint that country in a positive light. So you can't imagine that things were any different back then. William finally crossed the Thames at Wallingford in early December. Stigand submitted to William there, and when the Duke moved on to Berkhamsted, soon afterwards, Edgar the Etheling, Morcar, Edwin and Ealdred also submitted. William then sent forces into London to construct a castle, and he was crowned at Westminster Abbey on Christmas Day, 1066. So effectively, all these other pretenders to the crown, they submitted to him, they gave up their resistance, effectively, and William was then king, 1066, which is a date which really sort of sticks in the calendar in Britain. That was the date of the Norman invasion. And we now get more people arriving just in the summer from France on little boats from Africa than actually arrived in the Norman invasion, which is one of the reasons why people refer to it as a migrant invasion, is because the last time we had large numbers of people arrive was in 1066, 1,000 years ago, effectively. Do you know much about this coronation, Jeff, or any more about this time that you want to add?
Well, there's one thing. My native county is Kent, and the badge of the county is Invicta, which is unconquered. And it's supposed to mean that the men of Kent, met the Normans, and they carried large amounts of branches to disguise their numbers. And they agreed to submit to William as long as their ancient privileges and rights were allowed. And William was supposed to have agreed with this. So there must have been a lot of people decided to submit because there's no sort of Saxon monarchy left, was there? So what do you actually do there? It just seems to be very sort of strange. There is a lot of sort of questions still about this campaign which sort of need to be answered. You know, the logistics of the precipitous sort of attack by the Saxons on the Normans. But his coronation, I think it was quite uneventful, really. I think that's depicted in the Bayeux tapestry as well. Doesn't seem to be any sort of opposition to him in London, not that I've heard of. Have you heard anything?
No, I don't know about any resistance there. I just find it interesting there that you were saying that what they were concerned about is that their rights and their usages would be preserved. So I guess they were used to having a different monarch come in, and that what wasn't so important as who led the country was if the country's laws remained the same. And Britain was, I think, it's the only country when they submitted to Rome that was permitted to keep their own laws and their own permissions and usages. And the end result of that is that we have a different form of law in Britain than they have on the continent. All the laws on the continent go back to Roman times. You're not allowed to do anything unless they tell you you are permitted to do it. Whereas British common law is you're allowed to do anything you want so long as there isn't a law against it. So it's like a different way of looking at things. So obviously Britain must have had it must have been a powerful enemy to Rome for Rome to say, well, you can keep your laws, you can keep your princes, you can keep your royalty, because none of these other countries were allowed to do that. And as you're saying there, Jeff, the men of Kent, what they were concerned about is that they were still going to have all their rights and their privileges. And so long as they would have their rights and their privileges, then they would submit to William's monarchy. Now, as part of his efforts to secure England, William ordered many castles, keeps and motts built, amongst them the central keep of the Tower of London, the White Tower. Now, these castles, they're probably what the Normans are most well known for. I mean, a lot of them, they're still standing today. Amazing construction involved. And you think this is a time when they probably didn't know very much about geometry and blueprints and all the rest of it. I mean, I have heard that there were no blueprints for these castles. There was just somebody with a vision in their mind of what the castle would look like, and he would direct the people how to build it. And they'd have wood scaffolding, and these like edifices are quite amazing that you can still see around the country. There are lots of them in Wales. Edward Longshanks, who we'll be looking at after this, he built many of these castles in Wales. And I think that's probably what the Normans are most well known for, are the castles. And these fortifications allowed Normans to retreat into safety when threatened with rebellion, and they allowed garrisons to be protected while they occupied the countryside. The early castles were simple earth and timber constructions, later replaced with stone structures. Any thoughts there on the castles, Jeff, you want to make?
Yeah, that's very interesting, because if we look at the Norman castles in Kent, you've got one, Rochester, which is guarding the Medway, which is a very important sort of position. And of course, you've got the White Tower, which is the start of the Tower of London. And obviously, that wasn't there when Harold was defeated. So perhaps there was no real fortifications in England for actually any resistance to take place. So they had to actually go out and meet them with their field army. So the other thing is there's so many castles all over the place, and a lot of these are quite interesting to visit. Not too far away is Caerphilly Castle, and that was built by one of the Norman Marcher Lords, which is an enormous castle. So the amount of money they put into building castles show that at any time, they feared a revolt. And perhaps that was the spirit of the people against the Normans.
Well, later on in history, sometimes they would destroy these castles to prevent the Welsh from taking them over, or to prevent the resistance from taking over these castles. I think Oliver Cromwell started destroying castles so that he could prevent the people that were opposed to him from actually taking these castles over. Well, at first, most of the newly settled Normans kept household knights and did not settle their retainers with fiefs of their own. But gradually, these household knights came to be granted lands of their own, a process known as subinfeudation. William also required his newly created magnates to contribute fixed quotas of knights towards not only military campaigns, but also castle garrisons. This method of organising the military forces was a departure from the pre-conquest English practice of basing military service on territorial units such as the hide. And of course, by this point, they've got into this habit of always having a standing army that were actually kept. And that's one of the things that Alfred the Great did. He paid the army and had them working in shifts, effectively. So you'd have an army that worked for 6 months of the year, and then they'd go home and another army would come in and stand for another 6 months of the year. And you were required to have certain numbers of your men that would go into this profession. So what they're saying here is there's a different way that this was divided up, basically on different units, which isn't that much of a change. I think the biggest change was these castles, and also the churches. I mean, if you look at the churches, you will see that there are Anglo-Saxon churches that are there still, and they're very simple, but they are made of stone. So you'd imagine if they had churches that were made of stone, they would have had castles that were made of stone as well. So I don't think it was the Normans that were the first to build up stone castles. But also you can see that there's a massive difference between an Anglo-Saxon church and a Norman church. The Norman church have these steeples on them, and they're far more Gothic looking, whereas the Anglo-Saxon churches are quite basic, basically, and they just have this square tower rather than having a point on it. And that seems to be the main difference between the churches. Any thoughts there on these churches, Jeff, that they also used to build, or any more on the castles?
Yeah, well, the situation, I think that's a fantastic word you said there, sub-infeudation. It sounds brilliant. And I think what happened was that there was a great number of castles in the southeast of England, you know, which had just been on Motton Bailey, and they've probably been added. And there's one near Maidstone called Fernham, and it's called Goddard's Castle. And so presumably what they did at the start, they got together with their retainers and they built castles. And as things changed and quietened down a bit, they could actually send their retainers out to have their own sort of lands and their own sort of fiefdoms. But the other thing is, like, you think about the Norman sort of cathedrals, you know, and me and you have been to some of them. You look at how massive they actually are. And I think it was it Lincoln was one of the tallest structures in Europe for a long, long part of its time. The huge amounts of building, castle building and church building by the Normans. And it does seem to have dwarfed what the Saxons actually did. So yeah, perhaps we should need to look at that sometime.
Well, I have to agree with you there. I mean, quite amazing edifices. I mean, I don't think today we'd be able to rebuild some of these cathedrals that were done back then without electricity, just with a horse and cart and human ingenuity. And you look at the height of some of these things, it's just absolutely incredible. And I think, yeah, they built as many churches as they built castles. So they were concerned with defence and defence of the realm and putting down rebellion. But at the same time, they also wanted to atone for their sins of killing people and putting down the rebellion. So they would build these churches to guarantee that they would go to heaven, that they had also done these pious acts as well as these vicious retribution against rebels. By William's death, after weathering a series of rebellions, most of the native Anglo-Saxon aristocracy had been replaced by Normans and other continental magnates. Not all of the Normans who accompanied William in the initial conquest acquired large amounts of land in England. Some appear to have been reluctant to take up lands in a kingdom that did not always appear pacified. So the Saxons and the Britons, which had pretty much become one race by this point, not all of them were happy about having a Norman overlord. And there must have been some fear on the part of these Normans that they didn't actually want to become a Norman overlord. So it does show you that there was still fire yet in the Saxon spirit. Although some of the newly rich Normans in England came from William's close family or from the upper Norman nobility, others were from relatively humble backgrounds. William granted some lands to his continental followers from the holdings of one or more specific Englishmen. At other times, he granted a compact grouping of lands previously held by many different Englishmen to one Norman follower, often to allow for the consolidation of lands around a strategically placed castle. Now, this certainly would not have endeared him to the British people, would it? Him taking away their lands and then just handing it over to a Frenchman. And he was also known as William the Bastard, not just because of his parentage. He was illegitimate, of course, but also because he was seen as a bit of a bastard, basically. And he even admitted that, I think, on his deathbed. Any thoughts on these lands that have been given away to his Norman henchmen, Jeff?
Yes, that's a fascinating sort of subject. It would be quite interesting to look at this. The other thing is that not only is he giving lands away to all his Norman sort of friends and retainers and followers, a lot of people don't want to come and get these lands because they're really sort of dicey, aren't they? You know, they're a bit insecure. So the other thing is, how many of these people would have actually brought any women over with them? You know, would they be sort of just marrying amongst the sort of Saxon population? I would think that would have probably been the case. So, you know, we get a situation where you've got a very small number of conquerors and a very large number of the conquered. And this reminds me of all the programs we've seen about Sparta, which was based on this increasing militarization sort of a small elite to run a very large number of conquered people. So perhaps that was a bit of a familiar sort of sign for people that they're losing their lands and the new lords tell them what to do, and they're doing it in a language they don't, well, most common people wouldn't understand, until these languages eventually merged. We're talking about 1361 when the Statute of Breedon said that a court hearing should be done in English rather than Norman French. For a very long time, you know, the language of the upper class was actually Norman French. I think that's right, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you're correct there. And also, Latin was the language of commerce, so you would always have Latin that people could talk in and converse to one another if they were doing business. And I think the point that you're making there is, if they wanted to keep hold of their lands, then yes, they would intermarry with the Norman families. And a point that we should make is that these Normans, they were essentially the same people group as the Saxons and the Britons. And if you go back and look at the Danes, and I forget his name, survived the Jive, and he was quite surprised at this. They did DNA tests on some Vikings from Denmark, and it was pre the Danish invasion. And they discovered that they actually had the same DNA as the ancient Britons. And that's because originally they were all one group. I've talked about this before. The Saxons and the Cimmerians, they were the same people. They were on the edge of Assyria. And when the Scythians and the Cimmerians, rather, when the Scythians came into Britain or came in across Europe, they started being referred to as Saxons, and also the Germain. Saxons, or the Germain Scythians, meaning the real ones, because where they had lived before in Scythia, the Sarmatians actually moved in there. And then this is why you get British historians referring to Germany as Scythia, because originally they were Scythians. And then you had the Cimmerians. They also moved into Europe at the time, and they actually came into Europe before the larger portion of the Scythians did. And Cymru was, I think it was the Assyrian word for that group of people. And Scythian was the Persian word for that group of people. So you know it was originally the same group of people. So they made their way into Europe, the Cymry and the Scythians. And you had the Cymric Chersonese, which was in Denmark, which is a sort of Viking group. And you had Cymry in Britain. And these Viking group, these Danes, they another branch of them were the Normans. So when you've got the Normans that are taking over here now, they're essentially the brothers of the Britons and the Saxons. They're essentially the same people. They just have a different language, and they've just been isolated in a different part of the world, building their own style of civilization, building their own side of castles and churches and all the rest of it. But essentially, they are the same people. Because of course, today, people on the left will say, oh, Britain is a nation of immigrants. There are all these different people. What about the Normans and the Cymry and the Saxons? Well, they're all the same people. It's not like there were sub-Saharan Africans from the other side of the world. They were all the same people originally. And these tribes made their way into Europe, developed into nations. Essentially, they were all brothers. And just through selection and what was fashionable at the time, I guess, you would end up with one group would have more red-headed people in it, and another group would have more blonde-haired people in it, another group would have slightly taller people in it, and there'd be very slight differences between these groups, so you could tell the difference between them. In fact, there's a book written, I think, about 1950, The Races of Britain, and you can still tell the difference between the races of Britain, the English, the Scots, the Welsh, and also the Saxon parts of them and the Danish parts of them, and he writes about this at the time. Of course, today, multiculturalism, and we have all these different races in Britain, it's become very difficult for us to identify these different groups, but I can still pretty much tell if somebody's Scottish from looking at them. And when I went to the Baltic states, you could see that the Lithuanians had a slightly different features as well, like a sort of sharper nose, but you know that they're essentially brothers. But there are these slight differences between us. And yet there are massive differences between us and Arabs, say, or sub-Saharan black Africans, or Aborigines from Australia, or Chinese. Massive differences. They're clearly not brother nations. Whereas the Normans and the Cymry and the Saxons, they were quite clearly brother nations. Do you want to add anything to that, Jeff?
Yeah, that's fascinating. The situation with DNA is really interesting. I don't know if you've done your own DNA test, but it's always worthwhile. I did my own DNA test, and it turned out I was 53% British, which is English and Welsh, which are pains to the ancient Celts, 38% Germanic, which is like Saxon invaders, 4% Irish, 4% Spanish, 1% Viking. Now, as you get closer and closer to Kent, the amount of Saxon descent goes up to a maximum of 41%. So the average so-called Englishman is actually mainly Celt. And I think this is what's happening here with the Normans. They haven't brought a large number of women with them. They're mixing with the general population, and they do so because there's no difference between them and the conquered people. So how do you actually find out who's an actual Norman in the end? You probably don't, do you? You can't recognise a Norman. They haven't got funny hats on or something. So you don't know who these people are. You don't know what sort of origins these are. And they're probably sort of selecting the best people from the conquered to actually get married to. The people with some influence in the area, or the people that are of the sort a nobility, as it were. This is what happened in Wales, where the Welsh used to sort of marry the March of Lords, have all agreements with them and unions with them, and sort of joined forces with them sometimes in revolt. So, yeah, DNA is the sort of indicator. For example, it says that I'm 12.5% Scottish, because one of my grandparents was apparently Scottish, not that I knew him or anything. But there's a great deal of movement around the country, a great deal of people sort of married into other so-called ethnic groups where they're not actually a different sort of group of people at all. DNA shows that they're basically the same.
Yeah, I think the Saxons are mostly around the southern parts of of England. Obviously, you got the Celts or the Cymry. They're off in Wales. Then you've got Danish blood starts coming in the north of England. And in Scotland, and you've got Scandinavian blood there. Essentially, they're all brother nations, effectively. The medieval chronicler William of Malmesbury says that the king also seized and depopulated many miles of land, 36 parishes, turning it into the Royal New Forest to support his enthusiastic enjoyment of hunting. Modern historians have concluded that the New Forest depopulation was greatly exaggerated. Most of the New Forest comprises poor agricultural lands, and archaeological and geographical studies have shown that it was likely sparsely settled when it was turned into a royal forest. William was known for his love of hunting, and he introduced the forest law into areas of the country, regulating who could hunt and what could be hunted. And that would really just be common sense, wouldn't it? Why would you turf out peasants from land that they're farming on if you've already got forest land, which was ideal for hunting in? I mean, you wouldn't sort of turn something into forest land. You would use what was already there, would be the sensible thing to do. You know much about the New Forest, Jeff?
Yes, it's essentially a hunting preserve, like you said. It's quite an interesting area, but because you've got lots of sort of industries taking place at this time, like making of iron in the Weald, for example. But the New Forest doesn't seem to be particularly a useful part of agriculture. And there's lots of places around the country which haven't been really developed, because you only have to look at the difference between, say, England and Wales, for example. England's got a great deal of fertile farmland, massive, which would lead to a big expansion of the population in Wales. A considerable amount of the land is actually mountain, which is no good for raising crops. Yeah, so I think William would have sort of done this. That's the sort of thing he liked doing, hunting. But it's very, very much sort of an indication that the fox hunting fraternity are probably sort of descendants of the Normans, you know, that... the Norman elite.
Yeah, a good point there. And of course, since they banned fox hunting, now foxes have become a pest, haven't they, in the towns? We've got so many of them. The impact on England of William's conquest was profound. Changes in the church, aristocracy, culture and language of the country have persisted into modern times. The conquest brought the kingdom into closer contact with France and forged ties that lasted throughout the Middle Ages. Another consequence of William's invasion was the sundering of the formerly close ties between England and Scandinavia. And of course, before this, there was Canute the Great, which we also covered in Patriotic History, and you also had the Dane Law. So effectively, this was the end of all these Danish claims. And as I say, the Normans actually come from the Norsemen anyway, so they're descended from the same people. William's government blended elements of the English and Norman systems into a new one that laid the foundations of the later medieval English kingdom. How abrupt and far-reaching the changes were is still a matter of debate among historians, with some, such as Richard Southern, claiming that the conquest was the single most radical change in European history between the fall of Rome and the 20th century. Others, such as H.G. Richardson and G.O. Sales, see the changes as much less radical. The historian Eleanor Searle describes William's invasion as a plan that no ruler but a Scandinavian would have considered. And that's interesting, because that sort of confirms the Norsemen origin of the Normans. Because they're saying this is something that only a Scandinavian would have considered, this bold or audacious plan. And yet we think of them as the Normans. So I think it was a very big change. I mean, everybody still remembers the date 1066. If you remember any date from your history lessons at school, it's 1066, and it's William the Conqueror, and it's engraved in our memory, essentially, that this is what happened then, and our language changed, and the people that were the rulers before then, they stopped being the rulers. I mean, essentially, you had the Britons, you had the Welsh, then you had the Saxons, and then you had the Danes, and now you've got the Normans. And yet what we really remember is this change when the Normans took over. And I think you can see that there's a big change in the, as I was saying, just in the churches, in the castles. And that was probably the most radical change. Of course, what I hasn't really talked about here is the taxation. The other thing that William did was he caused the Doomsday Book to be compiled, which was basically a list of all the land ownings and that everybody in Britain had, so that he could then collect a tax from them. And of course, he also brought the Jews with him. There were no Jews in Britain up until William the Conqueror, and he brought the Jews with him to act as tax collectors. And we'll go a little bit more into the Jewish history in the country when we get into Edward Longshanks and his reign. What do you make of this, Jeff? Do you see the conquest as being a one of the most major, most radical changes in European history between the fall of Rome and the 20th century, or do you see it as much less radical of a change?
Well, I think when we talk about change, we've got to look at what type of change we're talking about. For DNA purposes, the change was very insignificant. There's no such people nowadays who identify themselves as Norman. Apparently, if you've got the surname Fitz as part of your name, you know, Fitz Osborne or Fitzson or something like that, that is of Norman descent, because that's the equivalent of, say, son. Now, the situation when the Norsemen or the Normans sort of arrived in Normandy, they did actually do the same there. They brought no women with them. They married with the local sort of population. So when they did actually arrive, they was ended up speaking French, which is a derivation from their own language, which was essentially Norwegian. So when they arrived, everybody was behest to these overlords, but they was essentially the same people. So, yes, there was a massive amount of social sort of changes, but on a racial basis, there was hardly any at all. As I said, you couldn't tell who was a Norman or a Saxon. They could have black hair, they could have blonde hair, they could be anything. But it doesn't work that way. So, yes, I think there was massive great sort of changes. But what is important, there was hardly any racial sort of change.
Yeah, no change amongst the actual type of people that made up the Britons. Well, William's reign has caused historical controversy since before his death. William of Poitiers wrote glowingly of William's reign and its benefits, but the obituary notice for William in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle condemns William in the harshest terms. During the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, Archbishop Matthew Parker saw the conquest as having corrupted a purer English church, which Parker attempted to restore. Of course, that goes back to this point that England effectively became Roman Catholic after this point, and up to that point, up to William, it was Anglo-Orthodox. During the 17th and 18th centuries, some historians and lawyers saw William's reign as imposing a Norman yoke on the native Anglo-Saxons, an argument that continued during the 19th century with further elaborations along nationalistic lines. And I can remember being taught that the Normans effectively enslaved the Saxons and they were an underclass. But then you hear the same, that the Saxons did the same to the Welsh, and the Welsh were enslaved by the Saxons and they became an underclass to the Saxons. Effectively, these things happen. So that's why it's important that you have this intermarriage, because you can't effectively turn your own family into an underclass, can you? And these were essentially the same people. They were just part of these different tribal groups. These controversies have led to William being seen by some historians either as one of the creators of England's greatness or as inflicting one of the greatest defeats in English history. Others have viewed him as an enemy of the English constitution or alternatively as its creator. So quite an interesting fellow, I would say. I didn't know very much about him up until we actually did this did these few episodes on him. I can remember learning it in primary school about the Norman conquest. I certainly learned a lot more about it from now. And as I say, the next person from history that we will look at is Edward Longshanks. But before we finish here, I'll just pass it back to you, Jeff. Any final thoughts on what we've learned about William the Conqueror today or in any of the other episodes?
Yes, it's fascinating, the information about the Normans. They was an amazing sort of group of people, very dynamic sort of people, very tough people. And their actions went all across Europe. And, you know, it's just absolutely amazing. The other thing is, though, I think we have to remember that when invaders arrived, there's only a few of them. They haven't brought women around. Are they going to sort of import women from other places now? If you look at the ancient Persians, they went to India and they intermarried. They didn't bring any women with them. They're now known as Parsis. And Parsis were amongst the first foreign people to actually get into the House of Commons. You've got this happening right across all sort of historical sort of events, where the invaders come and they merge with the native population in the end. And, you know, sadly, there isn't anybody around nowadays who can say, well, you know, on Norman ancestry. And most people have neglected the Norman sort of influence on Britain or on England. And I think that's quite a sad thing, because their achievements were enormous.
And also, this merging with the population that's already there, I mean, it works absolutely fine when it's a brother nation, as occurred here. When it comes to America, though, and you have the Native Americans, the Red Indians over there, this is what caused the downfall of South America. This is why South America is not as great as North America. The North Americans brought their own women along. But in South America, the Pope said to them that they should intermarry with the people that are already there. And of course, this is why you have all these different mixed racial groups in South America. And I would argue that's one of the reasons why South America is not as successful as North America, because the North American settlers brought their own women with them. They brought a supply of their own women, and they didn't intermarry with the people that were already there. And I say, this is what the Europeans have been doing for centuries, and it always worked out fine when it was in Europe, when it was with another brother nation. But when it came to America and it was with a completely different racial group, then you end up basically just destroying your own racial group. And you end up with the people that are not as successful as the original groups are. If you look at like Spain or Italy today, it's far more successful than, say, Mexico or Peru or Colombia or any of these South American countries that were settled by Southern Europeans. But as I say, in the next episode, we'll look at Edward Longshanks. He's the next important person in history I think we should look at. And we'll also look a little bit at the Jews, because they had quite an important role to play in the history of Edward Longshanks. But we won't be doing that for a few weeks yet, because I'm going to need some time to get some notes together on the subject. I've got a very good book here called A Great and Terrible King, which is a really good biography of Edward Longshanks. So we'll use that. We'll also use The Brute or The Chronicles of England, which was actually written during Edward's life. So it's going to take me a while to get these notes together. So we won't be back for a couple of weeks now, but we will be back with another episode of Patriotic History. So until then, thank you very much for coming on today, Jeff. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back soon with more Patriotic History for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you. There.